Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
So as you are no doubt aware, the big TV debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump happens at 2 a.m. tonight, or rather 2 a.m. tomorrow morning. One of the most pivotal in decades, and one person who has a better insight than most into the workings of power in Washington, D.C. is Rohit Kumar, who's PwC Washington National Tax Service Principal and a former Deputy Chief of Staff to Senator Mitch McConnell. And Rohit is here. You're very welcome to the programme. Lovely to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
So how much are you anticipating this debate, which is coming overnight our time?
Yeah, so this is going to be, I think, you know, clearly after the first debate, which was, I think, will always be the most significant of the two, given that it resulted in Biden stepping down as candidate anyway. Look, this is high stakes poker, right? The race is tightening. The honeymoon period appears to be coming a little bit to an end. That was always going to happen. And this could be the last major inflection point in the campaign, right? We are within 60 days of November 5th. Early voting is starting to happen in several states, including some very important states like North Carolina. And so this is a big moment for both of them. Mm-hmm. And I think there are reasonably high expectations for both. You know, the Harris campaign has said, she's really good at this. This is where she's going to be. She's taken some critique for not doing more press interviews, not doing more unscripted media events. There is nothing less scripted than a presidential debate. And I think they have put a lot of, to use a poker analogy, they have put a lot of chips in the middle here.
Mm. And they have said, you know, this is where she will shine. That's what we have heard. But the rules mean that she won't be able to directly question Donald Trump. She won't be able to interrupt him because her mic will be closed when he is speaking. So there's a lot of risk factors for her here.
Yes. And the Harris campaign clearly did not want that to be the case. And this was the last piece that they were negotiating over before finally agreeing to the terms. But it's, of course, a replicate of the rules that mm-hmm. were in place for the first debate, where the Biden campaign very much wanted the microphones to be turned off when it wasn't a candidate's turn to mm-hmm. speak, which may have been, in hindsight, a mistake in the organization of that debate. But those rules are now clearly carrying over to this debate as
and
well.
Do you expect to hear a lot on the economy tonight?
I do. And actually, I fear, and I don't say this just because I co-lead PwC's National Tax Office in Washington, D.C., but I expect tax, actually, to get a fair bit of airing, as both candidates have been increasingly talking about their tax proposals. Now, they're talking mostly about what I refer to as the candy, right? Here are all the things that you're going to get, you know, tax cuts for you and tax cuts for thee. Vice President Harris has sort of adopted most of President Biden's campaign tax proposals, so raising the U.S. headline corporate rate to 28%, raising the excise tax on stock buybacks from 1% to 4%. She hasn't spoken in granular detail about the international tax rules. She can probably be forgiven for doing that. There's probably not any swing state voter who's, you know, waiting to hear what she thinks about OECD negotiations before they cast their
yes,
vote.
Yes, not exactly bread and butter not issues.
Yeah, I mean, it is in my house, but I don't live in a normal house. You know, we expect that, you know, she'll talk about, she might say, you know, rates, but more she'll probably, you know, say something like rich and corporations paying their fair share. That's sort of the political version of that. Mm-hmm. And I would continue to expect, to the extent that taxes come up, Trump to talk about extending all the tax cuts that were enacted under his administration, and then further tax cuts, whether it's no tax on tips or reducing the headline corporate rate to 15% or, you know, things sort of in that space.
Yeah, and of course, this is very relevant for Ireland. You know, if Donald Trump is elected and if he follows through on, you know, increasing tariffs on all imports coming in to the United States, and of course, the corporation tax rate as well, that cut, we should be watching this very closely.
You should. And I think as between the two, if I were to risk weight one versus the other, the risk of tariffs in my mind in a Trump presidency is much higher than the risk that the U.S. would actually reduce its headline corporate rate to 15%. Just by way of reminder, all of the individual tax cuts that were enacted in 2017, which affect every working American, expire at the end of 2025. So the Congress is already having to deal with several trillion, by several I mean like $5 trillion over the next 10 years of expiring tax cuts. Mm-hmm. So there's really very limited appetite on Capitol Hill amongst lawmakers to take on the burden of you know, reducing the headline corporate rate from 21 to 15, which would add another almost $900 billion to the tab of what's happening at the end of 2025. Republicans are not interested in raising the corporate rate, but they're not likely to be able to have the sort of political wherewithal to reduce the corporate rate. Tariffs, however, are something that the president can do largely on their own authority. And that's because over the last almost 100 years, Congress has, over a series of legislative choices, delegated a fair bit of legislative authority to the executive to impose tariffs by executive action. And so while no one has tested those authorities quite in the way that Trump is talking about testing them, it is not out of the question, not by a long shot, that he could actually do this.
And pharmaceuticals were on his agenda, certainly in the past. He said, you take a look at Ireland. He said, it's not only China. You take a look at Ireland. They make our drugs. Everybody makes our drugs except us. We're bringing that whole supply chain back. That's what these tariffs are about, right? In the main for him.
In the main. So there are sort of two pieces to the tariffs. There is a clearly a China-focused effort, and that's why China gets in the rhetoric, gets singled out for especially higher tariffs than the rest of the world. And then there is this notion of, you know, bring it back, onshore it back to the U.S. In a way that probably at the end of the day is not economically viable to have everything done domestically. And if you talk to lawmakers, so not candidate Trump, former President Trump, but if you talk to lawmakers, their interest really runs through making sure that the critical elements that we import as a country, we being the U.S. here, I speak as a U.S. person, are being made either close by, so you know, we share a land border with, so Canada, Mexico, et cetera, or are, quote, friend-shored, are made in nations and jurisdictions with whom we have friendly alliances and relationships. Ireland clearly falls into that category. So I think if you talk to lawmakers, it is there's a strong China focus. That's bipartisan, you know, because there's a sense that China is a long-term strategic competitor to the United States and may not always have the U.S. best interests at heart. Whether you believe that is separate, but that's the received wisdom on Capitol. You don't ever hear from lawmakers true concern about the sort of stability of the supply chain coming from countries in the EU, Western Europe, Ireland. That's not something that I hear about in my conversation.
Now, we're not fully clear what Kamala Harris would do in relation to trade, but I mean, we have to look at her record. She's been vice president, you know, under Joe Biden's term. So do we just expect that the status quo will be maintained when it comes to trade?
That's sort of my expectation.
Yeah.
You know, Biden did not undo any of the Trump tariffs, especially with respect to China. In fact, he added some new ones as well along the way. So I think you'll continue, I would continue to expect to see similar tariff policy out of a Harris administration that we've seen out of a Biden administration, targeted at China. But, you know, there's some EU tariffs in there as well that are sort of targeted at things like steel and aluminum, where as a U.S. lawmaker, you can make a national security argument that the U.S. needs a domestic industrial base for steel and aluminum, so that if we were ever in a, you know, a real shooting war, we have an industrial base to make tanks and weapons and things like that. That's typically the argument that presidents have used. This goes back to George W. Bush back in the early 2000s. He had steel tariffs, making sort of a similar argument. Although, in fairness, all of these tariffs also have a domestic political constituency behind them, as you know, elected officials are seeking to curry favor with a sector of the electorate.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the past, because I know that you were involved with the Republicans right up to 2013. Isn't that right?
That's
worked with Mitch McConnell until then. How much has the Republican Party changed since the arrival of Donald Trump, in your view?
It definitely has become a far more populist party than it was certainly when I was working on Capitol Hill. Right. And I think what you're seeing, certainly my perception as I lived through some of this transformation, we were in early stages while I was there. It starts with like Tea Party Republicans in 2010 and then accelerates through the Trump administration. Underpinning all of this is this sort of broadly shared economic anxiety that workers are feeling left behind by the 21st century economy, that their skills are not equipped to, you know, compete in the new marketplace. And it would take an exceptionally self-aware individual to say, you know, maybe I just didn't invest in the skills I need for the 21st century. I mean, maybe somebody's saying that. But the more normal human reaction is to say, it's not my fault, right? It is, I'm economically insecure and my wages aren't rising because of either low-wage workers in another jurisdiction, and therefore that makes me skeptical of trade, right? Because I can't compete with what they can work yes. for in a Southeast Asian country, or anti-immigrant, as I don't want people coming from other countries to the U.S. and then driving down my wages or taking my job or something in that sort of line of economic thought. So what you have seen over the last 15, 20 years is a shift in the public sentiment around trade and around immigration. And I think those are both symptoms of a broader underlying set of economic anxieties that we haven't yet really dealt with.
Well, if you accept that, then the Republicans are playing into a false narrative here. They're addressing something that isn't really the problem because you need to sort out something else.
Yes, you do. But they are like all elected officials. Like they're speaking to the symptoms, right? Someone says, my head hurts. They say, here's some, aspirin. Right. Here's something that will make the thing that is bothering you mm-hmm. go away. And maybe, as an elected, if I were to defend the posture, I'd say, look, I have to treat the symptoms first to ease the suffering. And then we can go and attack
the structural
issues. Some of the root causes of the problems. But addressing the root causes is where, the politics center. Mm-hmm. Right. Because the two parties have just very different theories of how you deal with the underlying economic anxiety. What is it that is holding people back? Republicans will make the argument, oh, it's overregulation, it's too much government getting in the way of the free market. And Democrats, I'm sort of, stereotyping here, would say it's just not enough government support. Look at the EU, look at the European societies, much broader social safety nets, welfare program, and the like. That's the path that we need to reduce the anxiety.
Rohit, I know I need to let you go because you've got a busy day. Yeah. Rohit Kumar is addressing the PwC International Tax Policy event today at the Intercontinental Hotel in Dublin. But it was a great pleasure to have you with us. Thank you for being here this morning. I also have Larry Donnelly listening to all of that, law lecturer at NUI Galway and columnist with thejournal.ie. Hello, Larry.
Good morning, Claire.
You won't be sleeping tonight, I would imagine.
No, I don't think so. Look, how could you miss what I think is the most potentially consequential debate in living memory and the biggest test of Kamala Harris's political career?
So how do you expect this to go? Because as we've just been discussing, expectations are high when it comes to Kamala Harris, but she's going to be in there with no aides, no notes, not permitted to consult aides, not permitted to question Donald Trump, which is her strength, we know, as a prosecutor. And all of the pressure seems to be on her going into the debate.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things Harris needs to stress continually is this idea of we can't go back. We can't risk the circus sideshow of another Donald Trump presidency, this time untethered to political constraints and surrounded not by experienced good people, but people who are just going to do what he says. She needs to paint that picture very, very vividly, because ultimately this is about a small cadre of floating voters who haven't made up their mind yet fully and could go either way. To that point, I agree with some of what Rohit said. About taxes, and in particular, her making the case that she will cut taxes for middle and lower income people who, despite Trump's rhetoric, he hasn't really done anything for. I think she needs to make that case persuasively. On the other hand, Trump, first and foremost, needs to remember that this is not a rally. He can't go off the wall and talk about Hannibal Lecter, et cetera. He needs to be more restrained. And for those who say he can't do that, they should look at the first Biden debate in which he was relatively restrained. And after the Biden controversy about Woody step aside, he kept his mouth shut. So he is capable of that, of doing so. Whether he can in the context of this debate, because he's seriously been flustered since Harris got on board, that's the open question. But if he can keep the focus on immigration, inflation, and Harris being too far left for America, he has a winning message on all three of those issues. Mm-hmm. The question is he disciplined enough to do so?
Yeah, and we've been hearing, haven't we, that Kamala Harris has been in a hotel over the weekend. She has been rehearsing with one of her team who is dressed in the Donald Trump boxy suit. Even reports coming out that this person is wearing a Donald Trump wig and is behaving and being and manifesting Donald Trump. And she's been run through the mill, really, in terms of the rehearsals. But we've no evidence or no reports coming from the Republican side that Donald Trump is doing the same. But the facts are that he is the most experienced presidential debater in the room.
Yeah, that's true. And the question is, Is he going to maintain that balance? Look, he had a great line against Hillary Clinton in 2016 when he said, you'd be in jail. But on the other hand, in 2020, he arguably blew it when he got so nasty about Joe Biden's son. I think an awful lot of Americans said, wait a second, this guy loves his son and has maybe done some things that aren't great or aren't fully ethical, but we understand where he's coming from, whereas Trump just came off as a really nasty guy. The thing for Harris is that she needs to appear, and I appreciate that there is some inbuilt systemic misogyny in the expectations game, but she needs to appear credible, likable, and authentic. And these have been issues for her in the past. And one of the things that's just come to light, which I expect Trump to raise, is a questionnaire she answered in 2019 for the American Civil Liberties Union, in which she said she supported an end to detention for illegal migrants, gender transition surgery paid for by the government for these people. Now, she's moved to the center on lots of these issues, but Trump is going to come after her on this stuff. And how credible her pivots appear on those topics is really, really going to be important to how she fares tonight.
And how much of a difference will this debate make? I mean, we're all fascinated because we've never seen these two together. They've never met, according to reports. We're all interested to see how what the dynamic is like. But if we look back at Donald Trump's debate with Hillary Clinton, I mean, it was really a given that that she won that debate that time, and we remember his behavior stalking around her on the stage. Still went on to win the election.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think that there was a factor in that election that I don't think is prevalent in this one, which is that an awful lot of Americans had made up their mind about Hillary Clinton and made up their mind in a negative way. A lot of Americans still don't really know Kamala Harris, because she may have been VP, but she's been in the background. And the idea is she needs to define herself in a big way at the debate. And that's why I suggest that she strongly highlight those bread and butter economic issues that I think have great appeal. At the same time, as I said, you know, she's got to answer that question. We know Trump and the Republicans are going to define her as being very far left. How is she going to credibly convince people in middle America, people in the battleground states, that she isn't this San Francisco leftist, that she's more pragmatic than that, and that she has changed and legitimately changed her views and her outlook? And how credible and authentic is she in making that case? That's the task for her, because the reality of time, we saw this with the Biden-Trump debate, the biggest story in these debates is, who is the loser? Does someone lose big? And that's where the consequences can be really negative for a candidate.
All right. We'll all be keeping an eye on that. Larry, thank you so much. Larry Donnelly.